Our next speaker, I think, will be known to many of you. Alex D. Smith has been an editor for several of the volumes of the glorious Joseph Smith Papers. Very grateful to everyone on that crew. Alex's contribution has been to the Journals and Documents series, as well as he's got a book on, coming out, the William Clayton's Nauvoo Journals from Church Historians Press. He's an essayist as well as an editor, having published in the Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society and an essay in the Oxford Collection, Foundational Texts of Mormonism. His paper today is part of, I think, a larger project exploring the motivations for Joseph Smith's assassination, and it is entitled The Threat of Mormon Violence, Prelude to Assassination. Are you going to use this, Alex? Okay.
Isn't that a great photo? I only say that because I took it. It's a...
I posed it.
That's true. Mark did. He did pose it. That was helpful too. Thanks. When we consider the causes for assassination, we can typically look at the psychological makeup of the perpetrator. One man's motivations to try to determine the cause. Alternatively, when we look at frontier vigilantism, this is not a funny presentation, please. when we look at frontier vigilism, we usually use models of mob mentality, mob psychology, mob characteristics. Almost 125 years ago, French polymath Gustave Le Bon, in his book called The Crowd, described the characteristics of a mob. And he said it's they act without premeditation, they're disorganized, they're less intelligent than their parts, and most importantly, perhaps, they don't retain direct leadership. The agitators start them off in a specific direction, but once they are headed in that direction, there's very little control or oversight. When we're dealing with the assassination of Joseph Smith, however, neither of these two models wholly apply. Joseph is not killed by a single gunman, lone sniper on a grassy knoll. I guess that was two people. Anyway, nor is he killed by a disorganized mob. Willard Richards says from 1 to 200 people, but it was premeditated. Thomas Sharp in the Warsaw Signal had published 2 weeks earlier, "Kill this man," essentially powder and ball to answer the problem. He had all but called for a time and place for people to show up. There was organization, there was a lack of spontaneity, there was continued control and leadership. So that leads to the question, how do we explain Joseph Smith's assassination? And in order to do that, we have to look at the motivations of a complex society, or at least a large portion of a community, deciding that murdering a man is the only legitimate solution to their problems. As Kathleen mentioned, this is part of a larger book project I'm working on, where I'll devote one chapter each to different threats that the Latter-day Saints posed to their neighbors in Illinois. When we look at murders on any TV show, this is my authority for saying this, when you look at any TV show that you watch, murders are always explained by money, right? That's surprisingly perhaps also true in this case. Brooke mentioned economic concerns. If you look at the list of agitators for Joseph's death, at the top of the list are people who almost invariably had direct competing commercial interests with Joseph. Of course, his political ambition, he's campaigning for president of the United States at this time, and also controls Western Illinois politics. Cultural values, of course, especially the practice of plural marriage is threatening to the Western concepts of morality, and also incoming saints, poverty, crime that's associated with that. Joseph Smith's legal power is an issue. He finds himself in the unique situation of being the head of both the ecclesiastical and legislative bodies in Nauvoo, and seems able to avoid arrest from any authority over the years. But the one I want to look at today is the very basic, fundamental human principle of self-preservation, a fear of Mormon violence. But when we talk about that, in the case of Joseph Smith, we're not talking about individual episodes of violence between Latter-day Saints or their neighbors in the region, but we're talking about this large military force that sits on their doorstep. But before I dive into this, let me give one caveat, if I may. Even though my discussion today focuses on the anti-Mormon perspective, I don't intend this to be victim blaming. Joseph Smith was not the author of his own assassination, but in treating this topic today, I want to look at a couple winter 1843-44 lesser known, lesser discussed at least, events with three objectives in mind. One, to demonstrate that yes, the threat of the Mormon Legion is a factor in Joseph's assassination. Two, that rhetoric among the Latter-day Saints changes about the Legion over time. We always talk about the Mormons' enemies expressing alarm at this military at their doorstep, but the Latter-day Saints talking about the Legion in terms of our civic duty, our patriotism, representative of us being good citizens. That shifts in the winter of 1843 and 44. And finally, my hope is that today I'll be able to add a little sense of humanity to actors on both sides of this conflict. Of course, the Nauvoo Legion is incorporated by Illinois statute, and again with the understanding that it would serve as a sense of civic duty for the Latter-day Saints. That's how they were able to participate and not in another unit of the Illinois militia. The Legion, they write this in a proclamation 2 weeks after the Legion's created. The Legion embraces all our military power will enable us to perform our military duty. It will enable us to show our attachment to the state and nation as a people. Well, the first actual action of the Legion was to participate in the festivities surrounding the laying of the cornerstone of the Nauvoo Temple, and the newspapers in the area were immediately very positive. But within a couple of weeks, that starts to change and head south. So in the Warsaw Signal in July, we have this statement by Thomas Sharp: how military these people are becoming. Everything they say or do seems to breathe the spirit of military tactics. Their prophet appears on all great occasions in his splendid regimental dress, signs his name Lieutenant General, and more titles are to be found in the Legion than any one book on military tactics can produce. Truly, fighting must be a part of the creed of these saints. Brooke talked a few minutes ago about an episode where William Harris is giving a lecture in Montrose and is attacked by Mormons in attendance. Responding to that episode, we have this statement in the local papers. They complain of persecution and mob violence. Remember, the Legion itself is created as a response to the Latter-day Saints' experiences in northern Missouri. They need to protect themselves. They complain of persecution and mob violence while at the same time they turn themselves into rowdies. Let these men no longer talk of Missouri mobs, for their conduct shows they are but mobbers themselves. We'll fast forward a couple years to get to these events I wanted to talk about. On a cold December morning in 1843, sorry, I don't actually know the temperature of the 5th of December, 1843, but the night before it got down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So artistic license on a cold December morning. On a cold December morning in 1843, Margaret Avery, Latter-day Saint from outside Nauvoo in Bear Creek Settlement, arrives in Nauvoo with the news that her husband and son, Daniel and Philander, wonderful name, have been carried across the Mississippi River illegally and taken to Missouri on charges of horse thievery. If it matters, I believe they had stolen the horses. That's not part of our story today. But what happens is that this episode prompts just a snowball's effect of legislation, of attempts to petition the federal government for territorial aid and territorial powers and military aid. Also, Joseph Smith sees this event as a reminder of the potential for conveying himself to Missouri. We're only half a year out from the third and final attempt by the state of Missouri to extradite Joseph Smith officially. He's worried this will happen. The city council passes all sorts of very extreme ordinances about protecting Joseph, protecting Nauvoo citizens. But for our purposes today, a kind of interesting development comes in the nature of how the Latter-day Saints discuss the Nauvoo Legion. Only days after Margaret arrives on the 5th, a broadside is published by the Nauvoo Neighbor where we talk about the event, reproduce some of the legislation that's passed. But on the far right column, helpfully not pictured here on this image, there are two letters from the current and former Attorneys General of Illinois, Ian McDougall and Josiah Lamborn. And at first, these two letters seem wholly unrelated to this event, and you wonder why they would take the space on this broadside to reproduce them. What they're actually about is whether a former officer of the Nauvoo Legion, now since discharged, should have his past commission paid by the city or by the state. So it's actually a very mundane technical matter of who owes this former officer. But the legal rationale that these two attorneys general give is what's interesting. McDougall says his conclusion is that the Nauvoo Legion are not to be considered as part of the regular militia of this state. Lamborn similarly says they occupy a novel position disconnected from the military communities of the whole state and in no way subject to the regular military officers. For the first time, we have the Latter-day Saints in their own paper emphasizing the independence of their military body, not saying we're doing our civic duty, saying this army is answerable to us. It represents a major shift in the potential use of the Legion as a threat. Now, this, of course, prompts some activity in the region. Colonel Levi Williams of the 59th Regiment gathers a force near Warsaw, potentially to defend themselves against Latter-day Saints. Joseph responds by mobilizing the Nauvoo Legion. The region itself is brought to the brink of civil war, which is narrowly avoided when, by Christmas Day, the two Averys are returned to their homes, make their way back. It is, however, only a matter of weeks in a still tense environment when another event occurs in Carthage. I don't have images of any of the actual participants, so you're using this wonderful little plat of Carthage from Plat Book One. So I think it's wonderful. So Horace Eldridge is a constable from Nauvoo who goes to Carthage to apprehend a man named Milton Cook on the charge of bastardy. When he gets there, he finds Cook to have his own little cadre of friends that are armed. And depending on whose account you read of this episode, we move back and forth in escalation. More men to this side, more men to the posse, more men to this side, and over a two-day period, again, come close to blows. Again, nothing in terms of actual violence. I think perceived violence is more important than actual in looking at motivations for Joseph's death. What's important about this event is that it prompts a series of debate in local papers about how to address this threat of Mormon violence. What is the answer to this question? Thomas Gregg, who later becomes the famous historian of Hancock County and is at the time the editor of the Warsaw Message, writes, a fairly moderate position here. In view of these things, the question occurs to us whether there is not some common ground on which the two parties may meet. This is not for the hoary monster who rules at Nauvoo. We feel sure that a majority even of his most firm supporters would prefer peace and quietness to murder and rapine. He says, to all such, we appeal. Similarly, John Byhosh, editor of the Alton Telegraph, kind of echoes the same sentiment. No man in his senses will accuse us of either favor or partiality toward the Mormons. They had written enough critical things over the years. Unprincipled, unworthy of the countenance of all honest men the leader may be, they are nevertheless citizens of the state of Illinois, and as such are entitled to the protection that the Constitution and laws of the state throw around the person, property, and liberty of the most favored in our midst. But these more tempered positions were balanced by people looking for more action. A man named, labeling himself Farmer's Guard, says, "We see and know that the very individuals will go to any length, even hazard their lives, for Joseph and his measures. We see that by their knavish and tyrannical conduct, they have been compelled to leave every place they have yet lived. And from their conduct here, I think they deserve to live among no civilized people." Well, Greg quickly responds to this and says, "We will go as far as anyone in bringing the real criminal to justice by the force of law. Beyond this, we cannot go. The verdict of the American people will ever be against those who resort to force to effect their own purposes. It has ever been so. It is so now." Of course, only 2 weeks after Thomas Gregg writes this, his paper is once again assumed under the editorship of his future brother-in-law, Thomas Sharp, who will use the very pages of that same paper to call vocally for Joseph's assassination. We won't spend any time talking about the Nauvoo Expositor episode. Clearly, the most important milestone in the use of the Legion itself, along with Joseph's declaring a martial law on Nauvoo, in terms of immediate catalysts for the martyrdom. But moving then past the actual event, only 13 days after Joseph and Hiram are killed, Thomas Sharp, in an article titled "The Act and the Apology," little alert, it lacks a lot in the way of apology. Look at this quote. "A man may take the life of his fellow man in self-defense, and he is justified." Thomas Sharp is describing 100 to 200 men storming a jail to kill the prisoner inside as an act of self-defense. So what does that really mean? By threat of violence, he, Joseph, endeavored to silence those over whom his city had no jurisdiction. It's Joseph's power. It's not what he can do from a jail cell. Room for the Stigall family. Anyway, the question is what Joseph can exercise in terms of military power that is the threat. If I don't mention in closing that Sharp and the men who killed Joseph did not represent the whole community, Brian will call me on it in his comments in a few minutes. No, this was not a systematic. If you were a Latter-day Saint, you loved Joseph. If you were not, you hated all Mormons. There, of course, is no divide. We're talking about communities, about towns and cities, and how they feel. Amanda Benton Smith, not Amanda Barnes Smith of LDS fame, Amanda is the wife of Carthage Gray Captain Robert F. Smith, the very man in charge of the force designed to protect the Smiths while they're in jail. Years after the event, she records a very touching account of her own experience that day. A little shameless plug, her entire account will be published in the next issue of BYU Studies, so look for that. It's really very fun. She writes, "They were killed on the 27th of June, 1844. She doesn't even say who. This is the very first sentence of her account, and she expects the reader to understand who she's talking about. "That day, I was unusually depressed and out of sorts, had been living in almost constant terror of the Mormons for years." Almost constant terror of the Mormon for years. "And never knew from day to day and hardly from one hour to another what dreadful catastrophe would happen. When the runner reached me about 2:30 p.m. that a mob had collected on the prairie a few miles out of town and were on the road to Carthage, some thought they were the Mormons coming to liberate the Smiths from jail and would destroy the town and everything in it. I heard the firing of many guns. I got up from my chair to go to the front door, but was powerless to move for a minute or so. When I became conscious, there was a Mormon girl who lived in the neighborhood standing in the door. I was holding on to the back of my chair. She was wringing her hands and saying, 'Oh my God, Mrs. Smith, they're shooting the men down at the jail and throwing them out of the window.'" Amanda goes on for the next 14 pages to describe her nighttime flight outside of Carthage with her six children. Oldest is 8 years old, youngest is 15 months, as they head 5-6 miles outside of town along with everyone else. She describes the town being deserted in anticipation of retaliation from the Mormons that, of course, never came. But if there's a beauty to Amanda's account, and I believe there is, it's that it demonstrates that the men and women on both sides of this conflict in Hancock County had similar interests in protecting their own lives, their own families, their own businesses, their own interests. In conclusion, I believe that Joseph Smith's assassination is one of the most important and one of the most misunderstood events in our history. I hope that by taking a little closer look at the causes and motivations of those involved, that we can come to understand what would compel a people to drive their neighbors out of their city, what would compel a community to decide that someone needed to die. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It's also good to be in a place where we can feel our history as well as think it. Our final paper will be presented by Dr. Brady Winslow. Just received his doctorate of philosophy, in history from Texas Christian University. His dissertation was Receptivity of Mormonism in the Upper Mississippi Valley, 1830-1860. He's published in Mormon Historical Studies and the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. He has essays forthcoming in the Annals of Iowa and articles from the Religious Studies Center. He's a frequent presenter in academic conferences, and his paper today is As Long as They Are Good Citizens, They Shall Not Be Molested: Mormonism and the Obligations of Citizenship in Antebellum, Illinois, 1844-45. Brady.
So before I begin, I need to mention that my paper title changed. So what Kathleen just told you and what is in the program is not actually the title. So this is the title I'm working with for today. It is impossible that the two communities can long live together. Aftermath of the murder of the Smiths, July 1844 through October 1845. Prior to the summer of 1844, a noticeable division developed among anti-Mormons in Hancock County, Illinois. Most believed that lawful means should be used in dealing with the saints, while others opened up to the possibility of using force against church members. Both groups were furious with the seeming inability to bring Mormon lawbreakers to justice. When anti-Mormons felt that the saints had gone too far in transgressing the law, some of them resorted to extra-legal violence to enforce it. The result was the killing of Joseph and Hiram Smith. Following the Smiths' death, it was not inevitable that the Mormons would abandon Illinois. One thing is clear, however, many individuals in the state wanted the saints gone. In August 1844, less than 2 months after a mob murdered the Smiths, residents from the nearby town of Warsaw expressed that it is impossible that the two communities can long live together. Church members, they said, can never assimilate. We repeat our firm conviction that one or the other must leave. These non-Mormons complained that the old citizens are now virtually disfranchised. They have no guarantee of protection from the law. They concluded that as long as Mormons possess the means of shielding themselves and oppressing us, it can hardly be expected that we should live together in peace and amity. Despite these grievances, I argue that in the period from the summer of 1844 to October 1845, anti-Mormons mostly returned back to their earlier policy of nonviolence and turned to other methods of persuading the saints to leave. When these alternate approaches to urging church members to abandon Illinois did not have the desired effect, anti-Mormons felt justified once again to turn to violence and hostility to rid the region of the Mormons. With the death of Joseph Smith, one pressing issue, we all know this, the saints grappled with was identifying a successor. Days before Brigham Young persuaded the Mormons to let the apostles lead the church, an election occurred. anti-Mormons in Hancock County were not pleased with the results of the local races. As they had done in years past, church members demonstrated their continued strength and influence at the polls and elected all of their preferred candidates. This infuriated some non-Mormons. Carthage resident Franklin A. Worrell, for example, grumbled that the anti-Mormons are badly beaten in this county. He could not hold in his frustration. "I am mad, mad," he exclaimed. "Yes, mad as the devil. Damn such a set of miscreants as we have in this county." Angered by the outcome of the election, anti-Mormons in the county responded by organizing a grand military encampment. A circular issued on September 7th explained that militia companies in Hancock and surrounding counties should gather in Warsaw from September 27 through October 2. The assembly, it was said, would end with a wolf hunt. Such hunts were common in the United States, the first occurring in the colony of Rhode Island in the 17th century. On these hunts, men worked collectively to surround and kill the wolves and sometimes other animals in a particular area. In February of 1844, residents in Hancock County planned such a wolf hunt. What was proposed in September, however, was no ordinary expedition. The hunters would be anti-Mormons and the wolves saints. As non-Mormon B.A. Gallup from Carthage explained, the purpose was to intimidate church members. Several thousand men from Illinois, Missouri, and Iowa Territory planned to meet in Warsaw. They would travel through the timber and prairie, quote, forming a circle, and at last all meet at the temple at Nauvoo. You may judge what the object is, end quote. Rumors intimated that the grand wolf hunt was meant for the special edification of church members, or rather for their extermination. Warsaw newspaper editor and anti-Mormon Thomas Sharp refuted these speculations. He insisted the purpose of the assembly was for recently organized militia companies that were half-drilled to gain experience. He further contended that organizers of the encampment only expected around 300 troops to show up, and that the notion that wolf hunters would decimate the saints was rubbish. After Mormons complained to Illinois Governor Thomas Ford, the executive accompanied a force of state militia led by General John J. Hardin to Hancock County in late September. When Ford, Hardin, and the troops arrived, the encampment was canceled. Hardin and a small contingent of men stayed for the winter to maintain order. The governor, having thwarted plans for the potentially lethal hunt, Sharp embarked on a smear campaign. He worked to sully the character and reputation of the saints. He wanted to influence the public to sympathize with and side with the anti-Mormons. This may have been a response to the many newspaper accounts from across the country, as well as local prints, that condemned the killing of the Smiths, and was particularly important at this time because Sharp and others would soon be indicted for the murders. In these circumstances, Sharp started a campaign to expose all the theft and plundering supposedly committed by church members in Hancock County and the surrounding area. In September, he reported that 25 Mormon families left their homes on Bear Creek and relocated to Nauvoo. While in the process, Sharp claimed, these saints stole $700 worth of horses and may have also taken many head of cattle. In his next issue, Sharp reported that complaints about Mormon stealing in northern Hancock County are more numerous than ever. He concluded that no man appears to be safe in his property within the county. We conceive that it is the duty of the citizens to take some active measures to prevent further depredations. He proposed that county members create an organization for ferreting out offenders. This did not occur right away. In the meantime, Sharp used his newspaper to broadcast instances of purported Mormon robberies, though he estimated that we do not hear half of the thefts that weekly take place in this county. As an aside, he later claims that from the lack of data, he was not able to publish, quote, a tenth part of what actually takes place, right? So he's claiming that there's all this theft, and yeah, let's, you know, he's blaming it all on the Mormons. Thievery continued, and in December, Sharp called for county precincts to organize committees to furnish lists in relation to Mormon thieving and outrages, outlining all acts of aggression and thieving that occurred since the saints arrived in the county. Right, so he's asking not only what's currently going on, but he's asking people to go back and say, hey, let's look from 1839 all the way up until the current time, and let's list all of this supposed Mormon theft that's going on. And then Sharp's hope is that, you know, they'll send it to him and then he's going to publish it in his newspaper. Precinct inhabitants listened. In a series of articles titled Mormon Stealings, Sharp printed details of who had been robbed, what was taken and when, and the value of the stolen property. I guess what's interesting, right, is there's no effort to print how they actually knew that it was the Mormons that were supposedly, you know, doing this theft. In attempting to establish a pattern of Mormon theft in the county, Sharp wanted to sway public opinion against the saints. In a way, he argued that because of the lawlessness of church members, they deserved whatever happened to them. Aside from Sharp's propaganda campaign, other anti-Mormons used the law in their efforts to address concerns for the Mormons. Lawmakers in the Illinois State Legislature made an attempt to repeal the Nauvoo City Charter. Repeal, they thought, would prevent the Mormons from using their charter and its provisions as a shield from justice. The first such attempt during the legislative session of 1842 through 1843 failed. This time, however, members of the General Assembly succeeded. As had happened 2 years before, lawmakers proposed various ideas for repealing or amending the charter. In the Senate, some urged modifying the bill, while others found this futile. Quote, to put a stop to the evils which the people of the state had all witnessed, one senator argued, it was necessary that the Nauvoo Charter should be wholly repealed. Nothing less would satisfy the people. Nothing less would affect the object desired. Jacob C. Davis, senator from Hancock County and one of the men indicted for the murders of the Smiths, had opposed the first repeal attempt, but now he supported it because he thought the saints had abused the provisions set forth in the document. Another senator who introduced the repeal bill concluded that he was for giving these Mormons to understand that if they remained here, they should obey the law like other citizens. They should not be favored with immunities or privileges which no other people possessed. As if they choose not to act the part of good citizens, they should be dispersed. While one senator believed the legislature did not have the power to repeal the act, others thought the actions of the Senate in debating repeal were premature. Regardless of the debate about whether it should be repealed or partially repealed or amended, the Senate voted 24-14 to repeal the act that incorporated Nauvoo. Deliberations in the House took longer, but they eventually voted on the act as well, and they approved it 75-31. And hence, repeal took effect on January 29, 1845. In the wake of the repeal of the Nauvoo Charter, Mormon leaders discussed places in the West where they could potentially relocate. While doing so, they contemplated a scheme from non-Mormon William P. Richards. A lawyer and resident of Macomb, Illinois, Richards proposed to send the saints to live somewhere else where they would be separated from non-Mormons. He recommended church members petition the federal government for a 24 square mile reserve in Wisconsin territory to be set apart by Congress for the Mormon people exclusively. Patterned after Indian reservations, Richards suggested the President of the United States appoint a superintendent to be charged with the supervision and care of said reserve. Set off on land where it shall be unlawful for any person or persons not in full communion with said sect to locate or settle, the saints would be allowed to govern themselves. Mormon leaders seem to have not taken the proposal seriously in what appears to be an effort to assuage the animosities of anti-Mormons long enough to finish constructing their temple. Church leaders engaged Richard's proposal. they published their correspondence with him saying that they would accept such an agreement, but would need a much larger tract of land. Obviously, Richard's plan was never realized, but it was nothing out of the ordinary in 19th century America, in an era that witnessed Indian removal and the creation of schemes to free enslaved African Americans only to rid the United States of them through shipping them off to Africa. The proposal of a reserve for the Mormons was not a far stretch. It confirmed the belief of many non-Mormons that the saints had so threatened American democracy that the only solution was separation. Animosity for the Mormons heightened in Hancock County after a series of murders occurred between May and August 1845. A botched robbery in Lee County, Iowa Territory, resulted in the death of a man and his son-in-law. The thieves turned killers were said to be associated with the saints. Later, a brother of the two men tried in the Iowa murders was stabbed in Nauvoo and died shortly thereafter. Not even 24 hours later, County Sheriff Minor Deming, a Mormon sympathizer, shot and killed anti-Mormon Samuel Marshall, in a scuffle at the county clerk's office. After a murder on Rock Island, Thomas Sharp noted the increase in homicide in the region and wanted something to be done about it. This last murder was the fifth in 6 weeks within 100 miles of Warsaw. Quoting, this is Sharp, four of these murders may be directly traced to Mormonism, he said. With suspicion and distrust for the Mormons rising, county voters went to the polls in August 1845. Once again, the Saints succeeded in electing their preferred candidates. The anti-Mormons made no concerted effort to oppose. Some gave their votes to various persons, others did not even vote. This, Sharp explained, will show what value the old settlers of Hancock County place on the elective franchise as it now exists in this county. They are virtually deprived by the force of circumstances of the dearest privileges of freemen. There was also a special election for sheriff. Church-backed candidate Jacob B. Bakenstos won in a landslide. Sharp was not happy about this because to him, Bakenstos was the epitome of a Jack Mormon, someone friendly to the Mormons and opposed the way the anti-Mormons was doing. Bakenstos had moved to Hancock County seeking church member support for a political career, and he triumphed. By pandering to the villainies of the Mormons, he got himself into office. And by being a pliant tool of these cutthroats, he had succeeded in retaining himself in office ever since. September 1845 was a turning point in the contest between the Saints and the anti-Mormons in Hancock County because a small-scale war broke out. Infuriated by the Mormons' continued display of voting strength, anti-Mormons once again turned to violence. In the southern portion of the county, they burned homes and farms of church members, forcing them to flee to Nauvoo. In response, Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders sent men and wagons to evacuate the affected saints. County Sheriff Jacob B. Bakenstos formed a band, consisting mostly of Mormons, to put down the disturbances. The two groups, the anti-Mormon mobbers and Bakenstos' posse, chased after each other throughout the county. Encounters between the two forces resulted in several deaths. After these instances, Bakenstos' temporary occupation of Carthage added fuel to the fire. After reconciliation failed between the two sides, Illinoisans outside Hancock County intervened. The governor sent an attachment of state militia to restore peace, along with a committee to negotiate for the Saints' removal. To put a stop to the disturbances, the Saints agreed to abandon Nauvoo in the spring. While many people believed that the death of Joseph Smith would cause Mormonism to collapse, others thought it would galvanize the group. This latter opinion is what played out as church members came to see Smith as a martyr. Even after losing their city charter, the Saints remained positive. Apostle Heber C. Kimball told a gathering of Mormons that some think we shall be driven from Nauvoo, but, he declared, we are going to stay, and we shall build it up. The legislature, he continued, has repealed our city charter, but it cannot repeal Mormonism. Neither can it take away our city. The saints' optimism and their hopes for continued plasticity, however, were short-lived. For a time, anti-Mormons ceased violent hostility towards church members and pursued other avenues of getting the saints to abandon Nauvoo. When these alternate approaches did not produce the desired results, anti-Mormons justified the use of extra-legal violence. The irony of this is that they broke the law to enforce it. While the exodus of the Mormons from Illinois was not a foregone conclusion, non-Mormons took steps to bring it to fruition. Thank you.
We'll now have the benefit of comment by Brian Andreasen, trained as both an attorney and having a doctorate in 19th century American history. Brian is now a historian at the Church History Museum. Previously, he was research historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, and for 10 years, he was the editor of the Journal of the Abraham Lincoln Association, the premier scholarly journal in the field of Lincoln studies. It's no surprise, then, that he was called upon to help create the Looking for Lincoln Heritage Coalition and pioneered heritage tourism in Illinois, as well as a feasible study in which Congress-based legislation creating the Abraham Lincoln National Heritage Area. After Brian's comments, we'll turn to you for commentary through questions, so please be thinking as he is speaking as well. Brian?
I don't have slides. I was at a conference once when a commentator used slides, and they were the papers that had been submitted covered in red ink. So, not going to do that today. Though, Alex, I should have done that, right? Okay.
No, you shouldn't.
Okay. I was going to begin by referring to Spencer Fluman's book on anti-Mormonism in the 19th century to set a kind of a context for our papers today, but I think in the interest of time, I'm going to launch right into some comments on the papers, and then maybe if there's some time at the end, I might allude a little bit to Fluman. But so Brooke Lefevre, she reminds us that there was an Iowa side to the Nauvoo story. She argues that anti-Mormonism in Iowa was distinct in that it focused largely on land disputes and alleged criminal activity by church members, and not as much on power issues and church political power. Well, you know, with my background in early Illinois politics, I couldn't help myself but wonder, you know, how the issue of politics could be different in Iowa. Was it the pre-existing political landscape that the saints found there? Did Iowa's territorial status somehow make the story different there? You know, Illinois, after all, was a state with a decades-long history of contentious political party formation and intense competition with deep pre-existing tensions that were exacerbated when these kind of naive, unsuspecting Latter-day Saints stumbled into Illinois. But what about territorial Iowa? Was there entrenched pre-existing animosity between fairly evenly balanced matched political parties? Did Democrats and Whigs vie for Latter-day Saint voters in the same way that politicians did in Illinois? In Hancock County, church members were running to be justices of the peace, county commissioners, school commissioners. Was it the same in Iowa? When a formal anti-Mormon political ticket finally developed in October of 45, was it out of fear that Latter-day Saints might actually win some elections, or was it, I think Brooke probably takes this side, that it was more of a political cheerleading for the concurrent house burnings that were being perpetrated by anti-Mormons over on the Illinois side? A little bit further afield, did the 1839 border dispute between Missouri and Iowa, the so-called Honey War, caused some Iowa residents to view the saints' relations with Missouri in a different light from the way Illinoisans did? In short, are there factors that caused at least some of the Iowans to perceive their Latter-day Saint neighbors differently in terms of politics and community integration than did the Illinois citizens on the other side of the river. Does this perhaps partially explain how a truce of sorts could be reached between citizens in Montrose and Latter-day Saints under John Smith? Just some things to think about. Brooke focused specifically on two individuals, Keokuk's Laban Fleek and Montrose's David Kilbourn, as a way to understand and to tell the Iowa story. Back in 2004, in a retrospective on the 1975 classic Carthage Conspiracy, Marvin Hill mused that each anti-Mormon had his own individual concerns. And I've certainly found that to be true, that there are as many forms of anti-Mormonism as there are anti-Mormons. And Brooke's approach, I think, reminds us of that. On that point, Brooke, Mark Goodmanson here, it would be really good to help connect all the dots on the commercial and economic connections of all these anti-Mormons on both sides of the river that you're alluding to. And also, I would strongly urge you, it's somewhere in footnotes, to really evaluate especially the reminiscent sources of Kilbourn and Fleek. For example, Kilbourn's the main study, that was by his son, you know, many decades later, filtered through a boy's mind. So I think it's imperative that you really assess and evaluate those sources. Brooke also posits that Latter-day Saint aspirations for Iowa were dampened in large part by the rise of anti-Mormonism there. On this point, I would encourage you to directly engage previous writers like Stanley Kimball and others who suggested that the dissolution of the Zarahemla stake and the decline of the church in Iowa was caused primarily by the continuing ingathering to Nauvoo consequent to the building of the temple and other economic imperatives. So you might just acknowledge and address that. Brooke mentioned Joseph Smith's review of the Iowa militia, at least in the written paper, that caused consternation among some. And that made me think, what about the participation of Iowa saints in local Iowa militia units? Did their participation or their lack of participation provide fodder for anti-Mormons? And that's kind of a segue now to Alex, Alex Smith, who argues that perceptions or misperceptions of church military power was an important factor in regional anti-Mormonism. He suggests that church leaders first began to assert the Nauvoo Legion's independence from state control in the aftermath of the Avery kidnappings in December of 1843, and that this marked a point of no return in military posturing between the saints and their neighbors. In the wake of the kidnappings, leaders in Nauvoo redefined the use of the Nauvoo Legion in ways that seemingly confirmed anti-Mormon charges of militarism. I wonder, did the direct involvement of the direct involvement in the Avery kidnappings by Levi Williams, the colonel of the 59th Regiment of the Illinois State Militia, impact Latter-day Saint calculations? What did it say about the apparent militaristic nature of the anti-Mormon threat that the ranking officer of the local regiment was indicted for kidnapping? How would you assess that in terms of a range of proper responses if you are a Nauvoo city official? On a bigger point, and perhaps one way to gauge or monitor evolving fear of Latter-day Saint militarism would be to track the chronology of the local state militia units. Just before the saints began arriving in 1839, the militia structure had undergone realignment as part of a statewide and nationwide militia reform. New and rejuvenated companies were created two battalions, and those battalion members elected Levi Williams as their colonel in 1839. Then, as Alex mentioned, or at least in the paper, in early 1840, newly arriving Latter-day Saints attached themselves to Williams' regiment in the form of a new predominantly Latter-day Saint battalion. How did Williams perceive these new Mormon soldiers under his command? And how did he feel later when his regiment was stripped of all of these soldiers for this new Nauvoo Legion? What do surviving Illinois militia records suggest about the participation and efficiency of local state militia units, both before and after the arrival of the Saints and the creation of the Legion? Did the rate of new company formation accelerate? And if so, where and how? What was behind the creation of a new 2nd Regiment in Hancock County in August 1840, the 83rd Regiment, a full month before John Bennett ever arrived and there was ever any discussion of a Nauvoo Legion? Later, was the sudden creation of a new brigade within the 5th Division of the state militia in early 1844, was that a reaction to perceived church militarism? Or was it an attempt by Democrat moderates to contain the anti-Mormon fervor of Whig Colonel Levi Williams' 59th Regiment? Answers to questions like these may help inform Alex's analysis. Alex is right, and he made more of a point of this in the paper, to point out Colonel Williams' questionable activation of the Warsaw and Carthage companies within his regiment in early 1844. This raises real questions about the legalities regarding deployment of state militias, and I'd encourage him to really pursue that point more. Finally, Alex may want to directly respond to Marvin Hill back in 2004, who said, "It seems doubtful that the old citizens really feared the Mormon military force, since they had no trouble raising a larger one." So there's a footnote battle. I just wanted to make you aware of that. Okay. The interplay between competing factions within the non-Mormon community that played out in the sphere of state militia reform and reconfiguration is just one example of what Brady Winslow acknowledges were noticeable divisions among the anti-Mormons, and I would say divisions among all non-Mormons. I suspect that in his dissertation, he explored this more deeply than the time allowed for him to do today. Particularly the perspectives of moderate Democrats and those branded by extremists as Jack Mormons are often underrepresented or totally neglected in the historiography. Brady reminds us that the story didn't end with the killings at Carthage Jail in June 1844. He argues that for a little over a year after the murders, anti-Mormons retreated to nonviolence and turned to other methods of persuading the Saints to leave. I wonder if this temporary lapse into nonviolence stemmed primarily from the fears of the anti-Mormon leaders regarding potential murder prosecutions in the prospects of facing the gallows. Brady alludes to this, but I think this might be the key. For example, how much of the motivation for the fall 1844 encampment and wolf hunt was actually to disrupt the service of subpoenas and writs of arrest prior to the October term of the grand jury? Parenthetically, A.B. Gallup's admission that the paramilitary wolf hunt was intended to intimidate Latter-day Saints, you know, raises the question of just how nonviolent was the anti-Mormon lapse into nonviolence. It seems a primary reason that Governor Ford led a brigade of state militia from Springfield to Hancock County that fall was to help county officials enforce legal service of process. And the flight of the county's anti-Mormon leaders to Iowa and their subsequent surrender negotiations with the governor's forces seemingly substantiates this. Brady notes Thomas Sharp's newspaper smear campaign against the Saints for alleged thieving. Sharp's goal was almost certainly more than just to harass the Saints. Likely it was primarily part of his legal defense strategy to further poison public opinion with an eye to the upcoming grand jury hearing scheduled in October and then future trials. The newspaper columns track that chronology perfectly. Just as an aside, I'm not aware that anyone's attempted to systematically catalog and correlate all the reports of Latter-day Saints stealing from newspapers, letters, diaries, reminiscences, and most significantly, legal records and proceedings. Such a study, though an arduous undertaking, would be helpful and enlightening. If someone has done this and there's an unpublished database out there, I'd love to know. Have you unleashed the interns on this in the Joseph Smith papers?
No, but Bill Shepherd and Joseph Johnston have looked at it closer than.
Well, I'll have to get on it because that kind of database would be very valuable. So in the end, it seems to me that the anti-Mormon leaders were first and foremost concerned about saving themselves during the 12 months following the killings, up to the final dates of May and June of 1845, the trial dates. Accordingly, it seems that they shifted their focus of violence and intimidation from the saints to non-Mormon public officials, like County Sheriff Deming and other public officers. It is telling that it wasn't until the last court date was safely passed that the anti-Mormon extremists once again began considering widespread violence against the saints. In short, I'm not sure that anti-Mormon extremists ever retreated from acts of violence and intimidation. They just redirected it for a while. And Truth in Advertising, that's the Jack Mormon perspective, and I'm writing the biography of Minor Deming, so I tend to be looking at these things through that lens, that prism that typically hasn't been used. 4 minutes, or should we? I can quit. But okay. I'd just like to quickly allude to Spencer Fluman's analysis of 19th century Mormonism in closing. Remember that he argued how it passed through phases. Mormonism is a fake religion and a fake prophet. Then Mormonism is a foreign or alien religion. And then finally, a grudging recognition of Mormonism as an American religion, but a false one, a heresy. Fluman found the Nauvoo period to be a time of transition in these phases. But he proposed that it was the saints' religion that was the problem in significant ways, though critics could scarcely admit it. Beneath everything lay the reality that the American state was ill-equipped to arbitrate religious claims. The underlying problem, who decides what is religious in a disestablished polity? Force of arms decided that question along the Mississippi in the 1840s. Arguably, it wasn't until the early 20th century with the arbitration of the U.S. Senate over the seating of Reed Smoot, described by our chair, Kathleen Flake, that Americans found a way through political negotiation to resolve Latter-day Saint differences with Protestant America. Each of our presenters today might consider identifying elements of transitional anti-Mormonism in their studies, looking at Fluman's study. I think they're there. Critics often asserted their anti-Mormonism in the secular garb of political and or economic threats to American institutions and culture. But because American political, economic, and cultural institutions of the time were predominantly controlled and defined by a religious American Protestant majority, the peculiar distinctiveness of Latter-day Saint religious doctrine and praxis may still be at the heart of all manifestations of anti-Mormonism. I thank our presenters for what at least I thought was a very thought-provoking presentation. So thank you.